Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Sparking joy.
Here's John Williams.
That's what we're trying to do. Make you happy. Keep you entertained and informed. We spark joy on the John Williams Show, a la Marie Kondo. We'll get to that subject in a minute. There's lots to do between now and 3. That's when we're on the air, 1 to 3 weekdays, Saturdays 10 to noon. On social media, search for WGN King John. That's me. I'm not king yet. I want to be someday. I think it'll be swell for all of us if I am. WGN King John on Facebook, Twitter, and on Instagram. By the way, we have a news click, a daily web poll question we ask you each and every day. I don't have a new one yet. I know what it wants to be about, but I have to figure out how to formulate the question. We'll get to that in a second. First, yesterday's news click. Elif, what was news click yesterday?
When my old relative says those racially insensitive things, I, A, correct them, 40%, yeah. B, change the subject, 26%, C, ignore them and help with the dishes, 35%, John.
40% of you say you correct them, and then the rest of us just try and get out of that uncomfortable moment when grandma or grandpa or the aunt or uncle or somebody says something and you go, oh, Lord, what am I going to do with that? This is about the governor. This is about Virginia and people there. This is about the Ricketts. This is about a lot of people, as it turns out. And so we're all kind of grappling with that these days. 40% say when you run into that, you speak up. 60% of you said on our online non-scientific survey that you correct them or that you get up and actually, I guess, it says here 40% say, yeah, you correct them. And the rest of us try and avoid it or we just leave the table. And I guess I'm not too surprised to hear that. Anna DeVlantis from WGN Radio, you hear her in the afternoons with Ro Khan's going to say hi a little after 1:35 and break down the mayoral forum that they had last night. That was pretty good. Dow's not doing so well. We're off 304 points, though it was a pretty good January. Hopefully the correction will continue, although I do think there are dark clouds on the horizon, however distant it is, and we're going to have to, at some point, go down before we go back up again. But speaking of going down and going up, I'm just happy to hear this. Once in a while, I will tweet out, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. And by that, I mean support journalism. You can't subscribe to a radio station, but I think you should patronize the sponsors you hear on WGN Radio the same way. That supports what we do. And frankly, I really do believe in the people that advertise here. If you hear me telling you to get your knees fixed or get this pillow or consider that guy for a mortgage, I've dealt with all of those individuals and I know about what I speak. I never tell you something I do not believe to be true. Well, anyway, I think we should support journalism. I think it's never been more vital on the radio, on TV, or in print. The president likes to talk about fake media, and that's gained traction. Kevin Durant said he doesn't believe the media, and he wasn't even talking politics yesterday. And yet we will all be sorry if we don't have what we have. And the thing about supporting the media, about supporting journalism, those are not necessarily the same things, but I'll use them interchangeably, is that nobody wants to pay for it anymore. You say, well, I'm not going to subscribe to the Tribune or sometimes I'll just read it online or I'll check it out on Twitter. And it's amazing to me that these sites give you their stuff for free when others of us pay for it digitally and pay for it in print. I get the Tribune every day, 7 days a week. But you don't have to. You can click online and you get so many stories for free, but it really satisfies a lot of people's itch. And if they've exceeded the free amount that you get from a site over the course of a month, then they just don't read it. They click on somewhere else.
Or they use a different IP address.
Yeah, pick up another computer. The Sun-Times, I don't think, has a limit, do they, on how many free stories you can read?
I've never run into the paywall with them.
Yeah. New York Times, you will. Washington Post is tough. And I think they're smart. At least I hope they're smart about it because I am always going to the Washington Post because it seems like they're just on the front end of so many stories these days. And I don't subscribe to the Washington Post right now. And a lot of times I'm frustrated and I haven't subscribed to them. I got to go around. I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. I'm not bragging here, but I'm just telling you at some point you got to say no. The New York Times, the Tribune, the New Yorker, the Atlantic. I was subscribing to The Economist, but that's only because they stopped me out front and I signed up, thought I'd remember to unsign up, and then I forgot to unsign up.
Because you didn't want to hurt their feelings.
That's exactly why
you
I did it.
Such a nice man.
About 9 months later, I was still getting The New Yorker, The Economist. Like, I know what The Economist is. Actually, The Economist turns out to be a very accessible magazine. It's short stories, good graphics, understandable. It's not all wonky economic stuff. It's a nice little magazine. But the president always loves to brag that the New York Times is failing and NBC is failing. CNN Business yesterday, the New York Times posted another strong earnings report, which is sending the stock nearly 12% higher yesterday. It's up 15% over the past week. The New York Times said it hit a new high of 4.3 million total paid subscriptions and wants to increase that to 10 million by 2025. On the digital side of the business, the Times raked in revenue of $709 million. On the digital side of the business, the Times made $709 million. Which leaves it well-positioned to meet another goal, $800 million in digital revenue by the end of 2020. The stock is up nearly 35% for the year. Well, I'm glad to hear that. These journalists get stuff wrong, and sometimes they're busted for their biases, but then let's call them out when we run into that, and let's subscribe to journalism because that's so important these days. But remember yesterday, Steve, I was telling you about how Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota is,
had no charisma whatsoever.
It was kind of a low energy, but just terrific, you know, straight-laced lady who I think is a good senator and would make a great vice president. Only because I didn't think she had the charisma to win as president.
Right.
And he said, why is honesty not charismatic? I said, I sometimes think they're not.
I think it was, I said nice, and you had me thinking about that when I went home, and maybe nice isn't charismatic. I don't know.
Right. Maybe that was the word, yeah. I mean, I think she's honest. I think she's straight up, and but I don't think she pops.
I mean, despicable can be charismatic.
Right. Well, but when you read her on Facebook, for instance, Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat senator from Minnesota, whose constituency scores are very high and whose Senate scores are very high. That is, she's liked by her colleagues and she's liked by people who vote in Minnesota. But when you read her Facebook page, it's things like, I'm going to the casserole competition on Tuesday. Good luck to everyone. You know, or we all need to do better. Or, you know, she doesn't, you know, she's not real soundbite friendly. She doesn't say clever things that will travel across the internet really well and score a punch. She doesn't do that. And I said yesterday, I just hope that at some point I don't read something in the media that says, oh, but she's really a terrible person. And then last night, I, for some reason, clicked on Slate.com and saw the following story. Actually, this is from the Daily Beast. At least three individuals have withdrawn their names from consideration as Senator Amy Klobuchar's campaign head, in part because of Klobuchar's history of mistreating her staff, Huffington Post reports. Former staffers told the website that the senator has habitually demeaned and is prone to bursts of cruelty, often calling the staffers and their work the worst. Emails berating staffers would reportedly have large groups of other workers CC'd on them, reportedly adding to the humiliation. Three former staffers also claimed Klobuchar made her staffers schedule her personal appointments, wash her dishes at home, and pick up her dry cleaning.
So she's back in the race.
Now that's charisma.
Well, that's too bad.
Other staffers spoke to HuffPost, stood by Klobuchar as a boss, and questioned whether the aides who complained were falling for sexist stereotypes about female leaders with high standards. If Joe Biden says, hey, would you pick up my cleaning on the way home? You do. If a female senator does, you go, really? Really, lady? I don't know about all of this stuff. That's a shock to me. and I'm going to keep my positive image of her, but I'll keep this in the back of my mind. Speaking of images you have of politicians, what do you think of this Bill Daley story? Have you, this is the news click that I don't have yet, but I'm wondering how to phrase it. Have you ever cheated on a major exam? Like maybe all of us looked over somebody's shoulder when we were in grade school or high school or college. But did you cheat on your driver's license test? Did you cheat on your state licensing exam? Did you cheat on your Series 7 or your bar exam? Did you cheat on some, you know, licensing for your barbershop or your nurse certificate? I mean, you know, something really major. Did you ever cheat on that? Because Bill Daley is a smart guy and he's a capable lord. He's done everything you could ask somebody to do and be. And lo and behold, there's a story on the front page of the Tribune today. And it sounds like when he got his insurance certificate in Illinois, somebody kind of helped him because he flunked it the first time. It's embarrassing. I don't know what to make of it.
Well, it's the Daley privilege story that he's running against, and this only feeds into that.
Yeah, I guess. I was just thinking, well, I wonder how many people are going, yeah, I would have. You know, the story about Amara, I think a lot of people, if they can avoid paying taxes or avoid claiming income, they do.
Well, that's a little...
I love it when you make that sound.
But that's a different one because that's more current day, and that was sounded like an intentional omission, right, of...
Amara's stuff was innocent?
No, I'm saying it was not innocent.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, what are you talking about? Bill Daley was innocent when he had somebody fill in some of his...
No, he wasn't innocent, but it's in the... You have to put it through the long time ago factor.
Wait a minute. So I understand how issues about race change, say the governor or the Ricketts or the whatever. We had that conversation on the Mincing Rascals.
Yes, we did.
Oh, boy. Wait till you hear the Mincing Rascals
tonight. I'd skip it this week.
It's a really good one. But here's the thing. Cheating was cheating. Cheating in 1973?
Yeah, no, I'm right. I'm not defending that. And, you know, and back, I don't mean that, but I mean it was a long, long time ago. Whereas if he was cheating to get his insurance license last year, I think it would be a bigger cheat than 40 years ago. And I'd also be saying, what do you need with an insurance license now for?
Okay, wait a minute. Explain to me what you're saying again.
Well,
so if he cheated,
okay, let's take him out of it because I don't want to talk about him.
Okay,
hold on a second. He was 30 when this happened.
Okay,
thank you. Fair enough. I don't know what Steve's point he's trying to make.
Maybe I don't either.
Moral compass should be pointing in the right direction by then. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know he was 30.
Let's go to Steve Bertrand. Already in progress.
The only thing I was saying was that if it's your cousin and your cousin creates and commits an offense yesterday. Or your cousin commits an offense 35 years ago, the damage from the offense yesterday would be greater than 35 years ago. That's all I'm saying.
We all agree on that.
That's absolutely all I'm saying.
Well, but now ascertain for us the damage if it happened 35 years ago and your cousin's running
for mayor. Well, I think something has to overcome. I mean, because of the whole Daley privilege and people fixing things and, you know, having the silver spoon and all that.
We'll say it wasn't a privileged character, but it was just Joe Citizen who cheated, who not only...
Well, you just said people would not... You were defending Enya by saying, you know, people try not to report their income if they don't have to.
I wasn't defending that. I was saying, I'll bet there's a lot of that out there.
Okay.
Is that defending that?
No, that's not defending it now.
Well, I think if you took away the privilege, if the story is true, it's pretty interesting to me that, okay, you don't know the answers for this state insurance exam. You leave some of them blank. Somebody else comes in to help you out with a different pen, with different handwriting. That's just bad. That's sloppy work, people. Come on. If we're going to do this, let's at least do it well. Have you ever signed... Have you ever done Sharon's signature on a check or on an insurance form?
Are you asking me on the air if I've committed a crime?
I did the other day, and I'm pretty good at it.
You signed Sharon's name?
I did. I took $200 out of Sharon's checking account. About cheating, this text is just poured in. 847 says, hey, guess what? It's just people being human. 630 said, John, Google and Twitter can be profitable without charging their users. Why can't digital media? Google and Twitter make money by selling your information or posting advertising, but I was also under the impression that Twitter is not profitable. The Twitter has giant amounts of income coming in, but it has giant expenses. And weirdly, Twitter is not a profitable venture. Producer Aleph looked it up and said, I think they are. She's going to run a document into me. And then a lot of you are giving me text messages on how to get around paywalls of the Sun-Times and Tribune, but I don't want to read these on the air. My very point is, if you enjoy the journalism that those expensive reporters provide, and not all of them are that well paid anymore, we have to find a way to pay for that. This stuff going on at City Hall right now with Danny Solis and all of these people, the stuff that the Tribune is doing these days, we benefit from that. I know you know this, but I mean, come on, guys. We won't know that if those operations are not viable and profitable and vigorous and strong. Open up the sports section of the Tribune and tell me how many ads you see there. They do not have the ad revenue they used to, and they have to figure out how to monetize it. My answer to this has always been and remains that we should all be charged per click. Every time you click on a page on the internet, you should be charged a micro charge. It should be a fraction of a penny, and you'll be charged a fair amount. Look at what your cable bill is these days. You're used to that. Nobody likes their cable bill. We pay $200 for cable TV. It used to be free. Well, guess what? We should pay a smaller amount than that every month for journalism, for information, instead of finding ways around paywall. This is John Williams. Somebody texted in, I don't know what's scarier, Bill Daley's failure to pass the test the first time, the state insurance exam, because, writes 224, it's not really a hard test, or the idea that they use different ink and different handwriting when they cheated. Well, that's the allegation. The story's in the Tribune, and we were just asking you if you've ever cheated on a big test. And I don't know how to make that a news click question. We did ask earlier if Twitter is profitable. I was championing the cause of journalism across all platforms, print and television and certainly WGN radio. And somebody said, well, why is it that Twitter is profitable and these other companies can't be? And I said, I don't know that Twitter is profitable. Elif, what did you find out, please?
According to New York Times, Twitter's net income for the fourth quarter last year was $255 million. After losing money for years, Twitter has now posted five straight quarters of profits.
So they lost money for years, now five straight quarters. Twitter's been around a while, and okay, now they've racked up five straight quarters of profits, a couple hundred mil. They grossed close to $1 billion, and then after expenses, I don't know what they are. I could run Twitter for less than $800 million or $600 million. Anyway, after expenses, they made a couple hundred million dollars in the last quarter of last year. How about them apples? Anna DeVlantis co-emceed a mayoral forum last night, and I think she's on. Hey, Anna, this is John. You're on the air. Are you good?
Yeah. Hey, John, how are you?
I don't know. I know you're busy, and I know you're probably... Are you on your way in, or where are you right now, Anna DeVlantis?
Yeah, I'm on my way in.
All right, well, let's give this a try. If it works out, we'll do it. If not, I'll let you go. I want you to drive safely, and let's see how the connection
is. I just pulled over the side of the road. As long as the sound is okay.
Sounds
or kinda... I could try to find, like, a foyer of a building or something.
Yeah, it sounds kind of weird, but let's give it a go. So tell me about the mayoral forum last night. I heard some pop. You and I were kind of kidding when we did crosstalk yesterday at 3 o'clock that you want to get information, but you also would like the gang to mix it up a little bit. It sounded like they mixed it up a little bit.
I think they totally did. I mean, it was you never know how these things are going to go, and it turned out to be a lively, spirited discussion, and you could certainly tell who the front runners were because they were taking a lot of jabs and jabbing back at others as well. You know, you saw it was so many moments last night. You saw, you know, Susanna go after Bill Daley there at the end in her closing remarks about, you know, linking him to his brother's parking meter deal, the very unpopular parking meter deal, and how he was part of that Rauner's transition team. And, you know, look at you, look at what you're doing. And there was also the other thing I noticed, there was a lot of distancing going on. You know, you had people who are connected via largely taking checks from people who are now under the federal investigation or it's the center of these investigations. And they were distancing themselves. Like Preckwinkle was saying, you know, I gave back my money that I took from Burke, and you know, and then Lori Lightfoot jumped in to say, well, you know, that's only after the bright light was on you, and we were calling for it to happen. And
yeah.
Yeah, so there was a lot of that going on, too, last night.
That's interesting because Steve and I were saying, you know, they are good candidates and there are real issues and they really are grappling with it. But lately, it seems like a lot of the candidates are mostly trying to explain why they didn't pay their taxes or why there's questions about their answers on a state insurance exam or why they took funds from somebody. Here's part of that debate that you were talking about from last night.
Susana Mendoza.
Thank you. I'm so excited about the potential for our city, and that's why I firmly believe that this election is about the next generation and not just the next 4 years. I'm the one candidate up here who knows how to navigate the ins and outs of getting legislation passed in Springfield more than anybody else, and that will be an important skill set to have in your next mayor. I've also, as I said earlier, managed the state through the worst fiscal crisis in its history and been able to take on a governor who is intent on hurting our finances, a governor that actually... One of my candidates here, Mr. Daley, was the chairman of his transition committee. We don't need more of that. We need to actually focus on the problems of this city. And it's not like passing, you know, selling off assets like our parking meters, but actually putting the people of Chicago first. I'm there to get that done.
Would you like a bonus?
Clear.
Yeah, let's
I agreed to co-chair his transition as a Democrat, because I believe when someone wins an election and it is over, we should join together and not continue the BS that goes on in politics and help a governor. He did not turn out what many of us thought he would be.
He was terrible.
When J.B. Pritzker picked Republicans on his transition team, did you attack him for that?
No, of course not. But I was busy taking him on when you were just being quiet about it, Bill, with all due respect.
What was that?
I said I was busy taking him on.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. While you stood silent.
We're going to have to leave it there in order to get up to everyone while we're still on the broadcast. Tony Preckwinkle.
And that's the closing remarks. No. Wow.
It was, and you could tell, I mean, Susana Mendoza and Bill Daley are polling well right now, and so is Preckwinkle, and, you know, you've got this group of about five at the top, and they know that only two can make it to the runoff. And so, you know, it's very clear they're trying to differentiate and point fingers at each other and who's got what going on. There was also this theme last night, and it came up fairly strongly about the people who were in before, when Mayor Emanuel was still considered to be running before he dropped out, and that those candidates, Lori Lightfoot, Paul Vallis, McCarthy, were all saying, well, where were you then, and calling them out. So when we ask the question, if not you, who would you vote for mayor, several of those candidates said, I couldn't vote for anyone who got in after the mayor dropped out.
Really? Oh, there was a pretty crowded field before Rahm dropped out, but a lot of the people on your forum last night were after the fact, too, right?
A lot of the front runners are. You know, Preckwinkle, Susana Mendoza, you know, Bill Daley, they came in after. And I think that was sort of the knock they were trying to present, that, you know, well, okay, the case they were trying to make last night is that makes you more establishment, that connects you more to the machine. If you have all these ties, you couldn't run against the mayor, but once he was out of the way, it was okay for you. I think the other thing was, who's the least machine? That was another sort of thing. You were the head of the machine, Tony Preckwinkle. No, I'm not the machine. I started as a school teacher, and I had this past of advocating for, you know, regular folks. And it was a cool thing tonight. I think the best compliments we got were from listeners and people who were there who said, you know what, I made up my mind tonight. Because if you look right now in the polls, depending on which one you look at, between 20% and 26%, it's still undecided, and we have, 19 days for this election. There is some early voting possibilities, but 19 days until Election Day, and you have that percentage undecided. That's pretty big.
I don't know who I'm going to vote for. What is this soundbite, Elif, that you have over there? This is one that you also sent to us, and I want to play it, but I'm not sure on the setup on this. What do we also have here?
It's Preckwinkle claiming that she gave back campaign funds from Ed Burke and Lori Lightfoot.
I'm glad you got that because, I mean, so if they're running against the machine, that is, distancing themselves from the machine, I was wondering, Anna, how much of this whole Danny Solis, Ed Burke, aldermanic privilege, the way business is done in Chicago, how much these traditional Chicago power players are running against that.
I returned all his money. I returned all his money, and I've taken the strongest stand against him. I said, look, he ought to resign as chairman of the Finance Committee. He ought to resign as committeeman and alderman of the 14th Ward. And I pointed out that nobody should have dual employment, that this is a real challenge to our system and to our democracy. And I just said that if he's guilty of the crimes of which he's accused, he ought to be in jail.
Lori?
Those are the strongest stands that anyone's taken against him. And as chairman of the party, I stripped him of his chairmanship of the Cook County Judicial Slating Committee.
Ms. Liefitt, real quick.
With due respect, Madam President, you took those actions only after the red-hot glare of publicity was shown on you, and only after I called for you to do it. You took weeks to even acknowledge that you got the money. And then, frankly, you threw on Ann Burke under the bus. And then you said it was her husband.
Ann Burke has been a colleague.
But you know that a justice running for re-election cannot solicit money. And the invitation to that fundraiser was Chairman Burke.
All right, let's give Tony Perkins the last word, and then we have to move on.
Say again.
You know, Ann Burke was an ally in our efforts to pursue criminal justice reform, and an invaluable ally, and offered to have a fundraiser at her house, and I accepted. As I said, I've returned all the money from the fundraiser, and I've taken the strongest stands against Ed Burke.
It's an exchange with, obviously, Tony Preckwinkle, Cook County Board Chair, and Lori Lightfoot, who's one of the candidates running. Interesting stuff.
Right. Former federal prosecutor and someone who Lori Lightfoot and the head of the police board, somebody who says she's a true progressive and that she believes Tony Preckwinkle, while she has better name recognition, is not. And that was the point she was trying to make and did well make last night. And it was funny, though, because you have the connectivity between Alderman Solis and Susana Mendoza's donations. She gave those back right away. Preckwinkle waited yet a little bit longer for the Alderman Burke, but eventually gave those donations or those fundraising dollars back. You even had Bill Daley distancing himself from the Dailies last night a little bit. Yeah. You know, pointing out in several statements, I'm not a cool politician. You know, I blend the business world with the knowledge of politics. I'm not like, you know, sort of referencing his dad and his brother, you know, so I'm not going to do everything they're doing. But it was, I think these candidates realize there isn't much time left, and voters are making up their minds, and they're taking shots at each other, but they're differentiating themselves more. At one point, Paul Vallis said, you know, look, I don't have the most money here, and this is the stakes are so high, so I'm not going to be able to be on TV the most. But I urge you to go look at the candidates' pages and do your research on the issues. The forum last night was one way, but there's a lot of research available. There's so much available even on WGNRadio.com for people to really become knowledgeable about these candidates and what their vision is for the future.
I heard one of them reference the Bill Daley, Mayor Daley's parking meters, Rich Daley's parking meter deal that turned out to be either a bad deal or badly executed for the city of Chicago. But I don't know how he's responsible for that. I don't know how that reflects on him.
Well, I think they were trying to point out some hypocrisy there, because he did write an op-ed letter defending his brother's decision about the parking meter deal that did turn out to be a bad deal, I think many would say, for our city. He basically was defending the times. We were in a housing crisis, it was a recession, and we needed these pension funds quickly. This was one way to be able to do it quickly. And so we sort of sold the future dollars, and we made a contract we might not have otherwise made because of the times we were in. But he kind of sold it then as a good business decision. And then when he became a mayoral candidate, he started to really say, I'd never do that deal, or that's not a good deal. You know, he got a lot stronger on the campaign trail. That's what the other candidates were pointing out, that there was sort of this, a little bit of a flip-flop on the characterization of that deal. I mean, you know, a lot of people don't know with the parking meter deal, we spent $20 million last year just paying the company that bought it for $1.1 billion for the spaces that went unused. So every time there's a construction zone or the city has to block off spaces, the city pays back
because they're losing revenue, right? So if you are, boy, on my block, they've had a lot of construction things going on.
Think about Wrigleyville or, you know, anything, you know, all the construction we've seen.
So if those meters aren't getting used and the company that did the deal with us said we were losing revenue, then the city has to pay a fine for
those unused spaces? Now, often a developer will have to pay for the spaces that they're blocking it off, but if it's city work being done or municipal work or all kinds of other reasons that you might be blocking off or they're, you know, or they're not working, that kind of thing, there might be. The city last year paid $20 million in paying that company back. So I think a lot of people, you know, I think time will tell, but I certainly we have enough. We have data now to know that it didn't turn out to be a good deal for the city.
I was amazed. You know, at the time, I thought, I don't know, maybe $1 billion is a lot of money. We went through that cash so fast. That was the thing that was amazing to me. I thought, now we'll never get any money. That it's amazing to me how quickly we got upside down on that thing. I'm out of time. Anna DeVlantis, you'll hear her with Ro Khan this afternoon at 3. I guess I can listen to the whole thing online. Is that up as a podcast probably?
Yeah, WGNRadio.com, and it's all there. It was an interesting night.
How about that? Nice to talk to you. Thanks, Anne. I'll see you a little later on.
Thanks, John.
Anna DeVlantis. You've been following this story about this interstellar object by Jupiter. There's something going on by Jupiter. And maybe it's just some wayward comet or asteroid or space particle. But the chairman of the Harvard University Astronomy Department believes that it's an object sent from another civilization. It's some solar sail or some debris from a spaceship, and it wasn't us. Which is kind of cool. So I'm open to that. But I haven't spent my whole life studying these sorts of things, and people who have think that he's committing scientific heresy. So what does one of the smartest people about this in Chicago have to say? At 2:35, we'll visit with Mark Hammergren at the Adler Planetarium and ask him what he thinks about the possibility that that thing going by I'll now demonstrate on the radio. I wonder what he thinks about that. By the way, things in space I don't think make a sound. They just go silently by. But anyway, I wonder what he thinks about that. I'd love it if it was an antenna or some sort of, you know, sail that's collecting sunlight and powering a gizmo. And it's traveling along the universe, then sending a signal back to planet Quang. You know, the problem always with that is that the signal to get back to the civilization, even if it travels at the speed of light, they'll all be dead by the time it gets there. And they would have had to have been so viable for so long for this to be a meaningful enterprise, they would have been around a lot longer than us. And then just think about that. Say you're way out there and you knew to come here and you hit Jupiter and went by us. What are you doing? So that doesn't make any sense. Anyway, we'll talk to him a little bit after.
I'd be so frightened.
2 o'clock.
If aliens come here, think about it. What's the food chain like? If they're more, you know, intelligent than we are, they're going to just end up eating us.
No, they're not. I mean, think about that. If they got here from some other place and you think we're snacks, they will have already had a food supply all along the way. I mean, how could they have gotten here? No, they're not going to eat us.
Bring up some great questions.
I think they're going to just walk around and go, really? Seriously? I just traveled 18 trillion years for this?
This planet got nominated?
Like, we made you and now we need to fix you.
Oh, you think that's it? We're their child?
There's all these, like, different Hollywood, you know, theories, right?
I have to take a break. We will explore all of this in the next hour. We'll also talk about a baseball rule change and tidying up.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
Poetry.
Here's John Williams.
I know what you're thinking. Mm-mm. Hey, John, how come you don't read more poetry? Read more poetry. I'm about to. You can tell already.
Exhibit A.
Well, there's that. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. Weekdays, we're here 1 to 3. Saturdays, 10 to noon. Valentine's Day is right around the corner. Two quick points about that. Number one, I don't do commercials for Krispy Kreme, but I have seen and have tried the last few days, and today they sent boxes of the Krispy Kreme heart-shaped donuts to our studios. Have you tried any of those? I just heard Lou Manfredini do a commercial for Seattle Sutton's Healthy Eating. We should all do that instead of this, but here's what they've got, and boy, are they good, and they look delicious. Heart-shaped Krispy Kreme donuts filled with a white icing or a jam. And on the top of the heart-shaped Krispy Kreme donuts, they have an icing the color of those heart-shaped candies that say, "Be mine." And the donuts have written in icing on that beautiful pastel icing on top, something like, "Be mine" or "Forever yours."
They're very pretty.
They're beautiful donuts.
They're
and
calling to us.
They look good. And oh, so I had one with the white icing. or at least a lot of one with the white icing, and wow, is that good. I mean, it's a bad idea, but boy, is that yummy. With a little bit of coffee, hello. It's the sort of thing that my wife doesn't want me to bring home for Valentine's Day. I did get this book, Love Poems for Married People. Love Poems for Married People. It's written by a guy named John Kenny. I'll read one of the poems to you now. Are you in the mood? I am. Let's put the kids down. Have a light dinner. Shower. Maybe not drink so much. And do that thing I would rather do with you than anyone else. Lie in bed and look at our iPhones. Yeah, you got to put the iPhones down, kids. And then there's this love poem for married people. Our love. Our love is like the padlocks on the Pont des Arts in Paris. Thousands of locks, symbols of unbreakable love. Isn't that beautiful? Apparently, though, all of those locks are too heavy for the bridge. Did you hear this? I read it somewhere. The locks are weighing the bridge down. So you know what they're going to do? They're taking them off with bolt cutters and throwing them in the trash. Isn't that beautiful, too? So now the people aren't locked together anymore. They're free to maybe see other people. I thought that was interesting.
Wait, is that a poem?
That's a poem. And it's in a nice little hardbound black book called Love Poems for Married
People.
That's
pretty funny.
Yeah. So maybe it's not for everybody, but it's poems like those that he writes in this latest book. Maybe it's something you and your spouse could share if your love is really a solid lock and you don't have to worry about it. Are you guys into that Marie Kondo stuff at all, by the way?
Have you been tidying up?
I tried a couple episodes and I really wanted to be motivated, and she didn't motivate me.
Yeah, it didn't really resonate with me that much.
Hey, you guys, get with it. This is trending. It's super hot.
Oh, it's so hot. It just shows up everywhere.
I mean, there was an article in the Tribune a couple of days ago, Marie Kondo on your books, and she's giving you permission to, if you don't love the book, if it doesn't spark joy, get rid of the book.
Hmm.
I mean, just everything. Anything that's clutter in your world, Marie Kondo says you need to hold it, literally physically touch it, bring it to your chest, and if it doesn't go boop, if it doesn't spark joy, then you don't need that anymore. That shirt that's still in your closet because it still fits, and it's a fine shirt, but you don't want to wear it, and you can't bear to get rid of it because it's still a functional shirt. This is me. Get rid of it. It doesn't spark joy. You should have joyful things. And literally, when you are getting rid of the shirt, you should set the shirt down, and you should say, thank you, shirt. It's been a great run, and then get rid of the shirt. But, you know, communicate with these items. So that's a little touchy-feely.
It's a nice thought, but I personally don't have patience for it.
You don't fold your clothes the way she does and then stack them up vertically?
No.
I've done that before, and boy, does that save space and make it very easy to access them. But it's a process to maintain. You know, like when you do your laundry and you fold the shirts and you just stick them in a drawer? No, I can't do that now. I got to fold them the right way and then create a space and slot them in, like maybe records in your old bin. Slot them in there vertically. Boom, 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 boom.
I do the rolling thing, but that's just because I feel like I have way too much stuff that I don't want to get rid of, and that's the way that takes up the least amount of space,
which is a good idea. And if you can see them and access them, that's swell. But she wants you to get rid of that stuff.
I would love to get rid of so many things, but I don't know. The next week I end up looking for it.
Well, then maybe it still sparks joy. You don't have to get rid of it. I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, I've read a little bit, and I think I have a sense of what she's asking us to do.
Yeah.
If it still makes you happy, if it still brings you happiness, I think you still get to have it.
Right? I mean, if I could just trade it up for a bigger house, that would be ideal.
Well, Brenda and I were talking about that because we went from 3,000 square feet to about 1,300 square feet.
Oh, cool.
So we've had to get rid of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So now I tell people, and they say, well, what's it like moving from the suburbs to the city? I say, it's great. It's all good things. You do more because you don't have any space to have stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So now you do more. And I think that's a good thing. But literally, if you buy a screwdriver and bring it home, you need to know, where am I going to put this screwdriver? I have walked into our condo with items in my hand, something I could hold in my hand, and I thought, where will this go?
Yeah.
I want it, but where will I put it? You don't have a big basement. You don't have a giant garage. You don't have a yard. You're in a condo.
That's exactly our problem. We're city dwellers, too. So, yeah, not very much space, but my 12-minute drive to work isn't half bad.
See, that's the trade, and mm-hmm. I don't say you shouldn't make it, but I think this idea of getting rid of stuff is painful and maybe valuable. I think there's a little judginess going on there, though. You know, Americans have too much stuff, and if we're leaner and meaner, then we're probably better. But to be honest with you, I miss a yard and a garage and space to put my stuff. What if I want some stuff?
Nothing wrong with a little stuff.
Well, I think stuff is fun.
Especially that garage.
I know. But you know, but here's what I told Brenda. This was my $64 observation last night, because I think that we were pining for just a little more space last night. And I said, but if we had a little more space, we'd fill that up. And then if we had more space, we'd fill that up.
That's what happens.
It's sort of like expenses rise to meet income. Space rises, stuff rises to meet available space. No matter, if you have 4,000 square feet, I'll bet you're using a lot of it. When we had 3,000 square feet, we used most of it.
So that's why I wish the Marie Kondo show would focus on more regular situations.
Agreed.
Because they take extreme, and it's easy for me to say, well, I can still walk across my bedroom. You know, it's not filled with...
I know. The ones they showed, I thought, well, these people don't need, Marie Kondo. They need a shovel. Just pick your crap up off the floor, fold it, and even if you don't do a good job of it, you'll be much better off. This isn't about folding. This is about bending over. Come on, let's go.
They need 1-800-GOT-JUNK.
Some of them do. Or they just need 1-800-BEND-OVER and pick up your crap. That's what they need. But here's the other thing. So when Maria's showing us, I watched a video yesterday, how to fold her camisole and her sweater and her clothes. And I'm telling you, I have napkins the size of her garments. I thought, my brother's 6'4", 250. Fold that. You know what I mean? Some of the stuff is bigger. She can neatly line things up in her drawers, but what of those of us who look like Americans? We got more space.
Yeah, how do you get the shirt to stand up like that?
Yeah, well, watch the videos. You fold it in, well, first you talk to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lay it down flat, and then you fold the ends over about a third, and then the arms come in. And then you fold it in trifold, and then if you do it just right, it stands right up.
It's just amazing what she's done to this country, though. I mean, you know, here you are talking about how to fold a shirt, and she is everywhere.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. Why do people sit through multiple episodes of this show, A, and B, how do people have, what happens when you say thank you to an inanimate object? Does the inanimate object all of a sudden become... What's that word that begins with an S?
Personified? No.
Sedimentary? Steve? Jen?
Sedimentary?
That's a kind of stone. No.
Hold on.
She also, did you say how she
sentient?
Talks?
Sentient? Is that the word?
Sentient. Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Ding, ding.
So she talks to the house when she arrives. She sits down and has a little touchy-feely thing with the hallway and stuff.
Well, I'm sure that's valuable to you. I mean, listen, I think...
You're right. I'm not putting it down at all. I mean, I really wish that I had been more moved by it.
By what?
I wish I'd gotten swept up in it. I really wanted to watch a couple of her episodes and start throwing stuff away. Didn't work.
Evidently, people are, because the secondhand stores in Chicagoland are chock-full of stuff right now. And they're saying a lot of people are doing what she said to do. So I'm all for that. The first part I agree with. If it doesn't spark joy, get rid of it. But if you don't want to take the time to talk to your clothes and fold them in a trifold and stand them up neatly, I don't know that you have to do that. If you have the time to do that or the patience to do that, I think it's better. But you don't have to do that. You don't just get a shovel, go downstairs, get some stuff, take it out.
I wonder how the businesses that do the organizing in Chicago are doing after this. Like, if they're seeing more people who are like, I just don't have the time to do it, but I'm going to hire somebody to come in and do this.
Sort, pack, sell, those kind of people.
Or like Mission to Organize.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think those are good businesses.
Yeah.
And listen, I think that if you don't hold the garment close, talk to it, and sense that joy, you're supposed to get rid of it.
Uh-huh.
Some of us won't go through that exercise, but your spouse will. How many of us have had a wife or maybe a husband who said, you know, you got to get rid of some of this stuff. Those shoes in the boxes, you haven't worn them. You don't like, why haven't you worn them? Because you don't like them. If you don't like them, but you still kind of have this attachment to them, get rid of the shoes. I have shirts in my closet that are fine shirts, and I have gone 12 months without wearing them, a full seasonal cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for me to say goodbye to those shirts. We've had a good run, and you know what I do? I remember how much I liked that shirt when I got it, and I feel like I'm betraying that shirt by getting rid of it because it's been a solid shirt.
That's why I make quilts out of my old shirts.
Oh, and that's why you say thank you to that shirt.
Right. So you say thank you for your service, and now I'm severing that bond by thanking them and
letting it down easy. Yeah.
Really, I hate to tell this to you. It's been a good run. It's not you. It's me. Julie, you're my first call. And you're next. We go to Julie first. Julie, it's John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hi, John. Well, I do want to share a miracle story about doing the decluttering with the Marie Kondo style. First off, I think it's taking the country by storm right now, at least in this area, because I started watching it on Netflix literally 2 days before we had that deep freeze. And then we had the deep freeze, and I couldn't go anywhere. And I'm like, you know what? Why not? And I took all my clothes, put them all on my bed, and then I was forced to deal with them. I agree. I'm not that. My clothes don't give me joy. But when I looked at them, I'm like, you know what? I had some clothes I didn't wear in a long time. I can at least pass them on to somebody else. And that gave me joy. I love the idea of folding them. And I used to stack my drawers. And so I'd always pick the top one every time.
Right.
But the idea of putting them in a drawer where I see everything I have, I'm like, I have variety in my life.
That is what I noticed. Yeah, if you do it.
Yeah. Better. And then I took a picture of it, Snapchat it with my family. And I tell you what, they sent it back to me. And it was like, oh, my gosh, we are having this moment, and it's not about politics. We can fight about this idea about do our clothes have sentimental value or if they give us good feelings. It doesn't matter because it's not about politics, and thank God.
Amen to that. Okay, Julie, I know you're wound up. I got to run. I want to get a couple more calls before our break. Thank you, Julie. Thank you. I'm glad you called. I'm going from you to Jamie next. Jamie, you're on WGN. Jump in there, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Good. Go ahead.
Okay, so I was telling I'm Japanese, born and raised over there for 20 years. And then you were talking about holding your stuff and then say thank you. Well, no, you weren't, but Marie was. I think it's more like a Buddhist mentality. Not that they're really super religious people, but I just known to do that from like childhood. Just, you know, before you toast something, maybe a little two-day-old food that you have to get rid of. Well, sorry, thank you. You know, the clothes you wore, but you've grown out of it. Well, thank you. It's just not like you have to be formal about it, but it's just the thought that you had a time that you shared with the clothes or whatever.
And you've done this all along, Jamie? You've done this before we knew about Marie Kondo?
Yeah,
you had that attitude, yeah.
I guess so, because I hate to say this. I watched only a few shows. She really didn't sparkle me because, like my kid, who is a mixed race, she said, well, Mom, because you've already holding the clothes, like she said,
yeah. You're
already saying the thank you, so that's why it's just like, oh, okay, somebody else shared the same thought that I do, kind of thing.
Yeah,
so,
it wasn't that great revelation for you, but for some of us, it's a new concept. Well,
yeah, because I think it's a different concept of Eastern versus Western thing.
You have sparked joy in me by calling in today.
Oh, well, thank you. Your show does all the time, so thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. And one more. Melody, you're on WGN. Jump in there. What did you want to say?
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for taking me. I just want to know why we're talking to inanimate objects. I mean, we can't even talk to each other. We text each other. Maybe we should just text the T-shirts. Maybe. I don't know. This is not.
Thank you for the call. Not a bad idea. Yeah, text your clothes. If you're busy and you don't have time to tell them goodbye, just text him. Hey, shirt. What's up? Toodles. So here's this story. I'm reading from the Tribune, and I'm not sure if they sourced this story or if they got it somewhere else. But the headline is, Alien Ship May Be Among Us. Harvard astronomer insists, despite grumbling and criticism from peers. And it's a story about this chairman of the Harvard University Astronomy Department. And evidently there's some piece of space debris that doesn't act like the stuff that normally enters a solar system or ours. And he said, oh, I think that's debris from another civilization, maybe something they particularly sent. And he said, you know what? Better that I be right and suffer your criticism than just cave like the rest of you muckety-mucks. And all the other muckety-mucks are going, dude, shut up. So that's my brief summary of it all, but that's just me. Mark Hammergren is in our studio. He's the one of the astronomers at the Adler Planetarium, and he's in our studio. Welcome to the show, Mark. Nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me here.
Do you know who this guy is, this Harvard dude?
Yeah, Avi Loeb.
Avi Loeb. And it's funny because the article describes him a person of great modesty who, you know, isn't looking for trouble, you know, which makes me as a civilian go, well, then why would he say this except he's really smart and he thinks it's true? When I described him as a person of great modesty to you off the air, you started chuckling.
Well, yeah, yeah. Now, there's a, I have to say, first of all, there's certain code of silence among astronomers not to make comments about personal character.
Okay, yeah. So then we won't.
So if we focus on the work. We focus on their science.
And?
And this, first of all, there's not that much science there.
What are we talking about, by the way?
So what what's spawned all of this was the discovery of an interstellar asteroid or comet. That is, an asteroid or comet, rocky or icy body, that came from outside our solar system. We've been expecting these for decades. We've been expecting to find them for decades because we figure our own solar system threw trillions of these things out when it formed. And so if other stars went through the same process, they should have done the same, and pretty soon we'll run into them. And
so these are
did.
Random comets or asteroids that aren't orbiting our sun, but just happen to be passing through.
Passing through neighboring just, space.
That's weird that after all these zillions of years, there are still bits of stuff out there that have not been pulled in, you know, the gravitational pull of some other larger object.
Well, see, that's the thing, and that's what happened with this object. It came in, it sped up as it approached the sun. The sun's gravity pulled it. And then as it passed, it slowed down, but not enough. And it left going as fast as it came in. Well, actually, a little faster than it came in.
What about that? What does that mean?
Well, it had what scientists call non-gravitational acceleration.
I'll think about that for a minute.
Yeah, it thrusted, basically. There was what's presumably, and we see this in comets all the time, because comets, they evaporate their ices, and that acts like rocket engines that give them a little boost. And the amount of acceleration that we saw with this object was entirely consistent with comets that we know of.
Well, why did he not assume that? He was suggesting that it had some sort of solar sail, something that harnessed energy and shot it out.
Well, there's other weird things about this, too. The chief one being that it appears to be extremely elongated. And now, that we didn't see the shape directly. It was too far away and too small for it to be seen as anything more than a point of light. But by watching how its brightness changed over time, you can infer things like its rotation rate and its shape. And we do this for asteroids and things in our own solar system all the time. And this one was unusual. It appeared to be extremely elongated. It varied in brightness quite a bit.
How big do you think it is?
Yeah, that's another thing we don't have a great handle on. It's within maybe a factor of 10 in size, so it could be anywhere from about 300 feet to about 3,000 feet long.
Okay, I can live with that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is this the Oumuamua, or however you pronounce it, that came past not too long ago?
That's right. This is Oumuamua, discovered in October of 2017.
So it came past Earth and then went around the sun, and it's back near Jupiter again?
Well, it's past Jupiter's orbit. It's okay. Not heading towards Jupiter. Yeah, it was discovered after it had made a close approach by the sun, close being astronomical terms, millions and millions of miles. And then it made a relatively close pass by the Earth, again, many millions of miles.
Did it come between us and the moon?
Oh, no, not even
those
that close.
Those things freak me out, Jack. I don't want that happening.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I don't need to tell you that. Okay, so keep going with Oumuamua here.
Yeah, and so it was soon discovered that this thing was moving too fast to be confined to our own solar system.
Yeah. I'm amazed that something that is maybe that close but still that far away, that you guys can determine its shape and that it's 300 or 3,000 feet long. I mean, that's spectacular to me.
This is all using various kinds of light from the object. To figure out the size, you have to get a combination of visual observation, see how much regular light is reflected off of it, but then also look at the infrared light, how much heat emission is coming off of it.
Well, then, talk more about this inference. I mean, the story is not just that it went by. I mean, it's been around. It's been in the hood for a couple of years now, but that this really smart guy from Harvard said he thinks it was from another civilization.
Yeah, see, that's the big problem that most scientists have, is the lack of evidence that really necessitates that conclusion.
If something from another civilization did come here, would it not act like that?
We would, well, it acted like a comet would. It looks like a comet. It's dark reddish in color. It's highly elongated. That's weird, right? It also could be brightness variations on the surface. All of these things have been observed in other solar system objects before.
Did it have windshield wipers?
Yeah, we couldn't see anything in detail about that. It was listened to for radio emissions, though.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, just in case, you know, because astronomers are open to that possibility.
Are they? So, I mean, that's what it sounded like, is that a lot of these guys were so dead set against what he was suggesting that you wonder if they would be open to the possibility at all.
I absolutely think that many astronomers, most astronomers, are open to the possibility, but only if the evidence suggests it.
Isn't it impossible for some other civilization to visit us because the nearest planet is so far away you couldn't get here? It's too far.
Well, I think that's one thing that highlights why it's a bad idea to invoke aliens as an explanation, because aliens theoretically can do almost anything. Field that we know nothing about because we've never seen them before.
Well, why would they come all the way here? I mean, what would be the say there's a planet and they're going to send something here. How far away are they?
Well, the closest star is over 4 light years away. And if something was moving at the speed of light, that means that would be a journey one way of more than 4 years.
Right. You got to have snacks, or I don't know how they live or what they do. But I mean, and that's if they go the speed of light. How fast do our fastest space vehicles go?
Tens of kilometers a second at
versus,
fastest.
So a fraction of that, right?
Absolutely
so
tiny.
It's not 4 light years, it's hundreds of light years.
It would take like 100,000 years or more to get to the closest star.
Well, then they can't get here from there unless they have, you know, they've traveled through some wormhole or something like
that.
Or
have
right?
technology that we don't currently understand, or some kind of colony ship, or just some kind of long-lived robot. We have to be open to all possibilities, but Carl Sagan used to say, we have to keep open minds, but not so open that our brains fall out.
Fair enough. So you study comets and asteroids?
I do, yeah.
Come nearby?
Yeah, near-Earth asteroids primarily, though I've looked at some of the other ones as well.
Do you worry about one of them just kablamming us? Because I do.
I have some worry about the smaller ones coming at us, and I think it's very important for us to look for them and monitor their orbits so we know where they're going to be going into the far future.
How much warning would we have? I thought that some of them might just appear on the horizon one day, and we've got a couple weeks, and then we're wiped out.
About the ones that might wipe us out, the truly large ones, there are only a handful of near-Earth asteroids that are big enough to cause a mass extinction like the one that killed the dinosaurs. And those are so big that they're relatively easy to see. And we believe that every single one of them in our neighborhood has been found so far, and none of them are going to hit the Earth.
What about smaller ones that could still wipe out a city?
So, yeah, we had an example almost of that kind of thing a few years ago, 2013, I think it was, over Russia. It was an object only about 50, 60 feet across. And it exploded in the air with something like the force of half a megaton of explosive energy, a pretty good-sized nuclear weapon. And it didn't cause devastation on the ground, but because it broke up in the air. It was coming in at a very shallow angle, but its sonic boom broke windows in more than 6,000 buildings throughout the area.
Well, how much warning would we have for one of those coming?
We know of only a few percent of that size population.
So, I mean, literally one could happen next week, and sitting here right now, you and I would not know it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how interested are you in technology or spaceships to go up and break these things up before they get here?
Oh, I'm very interested in that kind of thing. More interested in the exploration aspects, really. I don't think that we need to develop defense technologies until we see one coming. If we do, we're likely to have decades of warning.
Okay, but the one that's going to destroy a city, that we'd have a couple of weeks' notice.
Yeah, those right now, our surveys are really incapable of finding these things unless they're very close to us.
If one of them did hit, how would we experience it on Earth? We would just see the sky light up?
Yeah, you would see a bright fireball getting brighter and brighter. The one over Russia got to appear about three times as bright as the sun.
During the day, they were able to see it.
Oh, yeah. Came down in the early morning hours.
So how long did they see it in the sky before it exploded?
Just a matter of seconds, really.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah, and it broke up along the way.
Okay. But if one of those came and did that, you know, it's weird because it's not carrying explosive material. So why does it explode or wipe people out?
They're moving so fast, typically somewhere around 18 kilometers a second. So we're talking about maybe 10 to 15 miles per second. That when they hit the atmosphere, it's like hitting a brick wall, and they push that air out of the way. They also heat up to about 10,000 degrees. And the combination of the air blast and just the air being pushed forward is what really causes the damage from these small objects.
So the phenomenon on Earth would be super hot air.
Yeah, just a huge blast of air coming
that
down.
That would wipe stuff out.
Absolutely.
I mean, you think about that. It's not radiation. It's not TNT. It's not shrapnel. It's just a supercharged hot blast of air that's going to just pow, wipe stuff out.
Just like a downward moving explosion. Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. Crazy, crazy. Okay. So maybe that someday, but maybe not. What's your estimated probability that'll happen in the next 100 years?
Well, the objects the size of the one that came in over Russia, we estimate they hit us every maybe 40 to 60 years. Now, they come in randomly all over the place, so about 70% of them fall into the ocean. And something that size is not going to really cause much damage unless there are planes or ships nearby. So it's not really a huge threat. However, as you were pointing out with the defense thoughts against asteroids, asteroid impacts are the only natural hazard that we can predict far ahead in time. And we theoretically can prevent if we know about it.
Mark Hammergren is in our studio. He's an astronomer over at Adler. Before I let you go, what's going on at Adler?
We've got a lot of things going on. We have a new sky show that opened up in January, Imagine the Moon. It covers basically the history of human engagement with the moon. We talk about the Apollo missions some because we are going through the 50th anniversaries, but we also look at imaginative experiences, humans looking at it romantically, how would we get there, that kind of thing. And, of course, we're also going through Black History Month. We have a number of programs that are devoted to that subject. And I recommend that folks interested in any of these things go to our website at adlerplanetarium.org.
Adlerplanetarium.org. Mark Hammergren. All right, Mark, I feel better. Although I wish that thing zipping by us and off to Jupiter was, was a spaceship. You don't
myself as well.
Yeah, but maybe not. And I'm also glad to hear about the mass extinction thing because I think about that. But now all I got to do is worry about maybe we're due for one of those one every 70 year things to, you know, wipe out Naperville or something like that. But I'll just have to deal with that on my own. It's nice of you to come into our studio today. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for
I'm here.
Hey, how are you?
I couldn't be better.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Ro. I don't know that I would always say, if people ask me how's Ro, would I say he couldn't be better?
I say that, and it's always ironic when I say it.
Oh, that's
so
kind of what I mean.
It is really? How it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Could you not be better, Ro? Are you at your best?
I don't think I really am, no. But, it is what it is. Very informative day today on the John Williams Show.
Oh, thank you, sir. We did cover some ground, yeah.
I got a lot of detail. I got a lot of details. Also, between you and the noon business situation there.